The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Stellar lineup today. Barry Glendenning, good morning.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
Very good. Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm very good. And Johnny Liu, are you well?
Hi, yeah, good, thanks.
Yeah, nice to see you. Wilson, 41st most influential figure in world football, according to France Football, ahead of David Beckham and Rui Pinto, the fella behind the football leaks. How do you feel about being almost in the top 40?
Well, you know, there's a platform to build on there. I don't quite understand how Xavi's got ahead of me, but it's a decent start, and we'll try and build on that, and we'll work hard as a unit and see where we get next year.
Question from Jim, which is, if Wilson is 41st, where do you think the rest of you are? Johnny Liu, where do you put yourself?
I don't know. I'm probably the 41st most influential person at The Guardian in terms of football. So I don't know. I don't think I get pretty high up. Michael Dawson once referred to me as his favourite journalist. I think that's the one impact on football, but one tangible impact on the world of football. Michael Dawson, formerly of Hull, Nottingham Forest and Spurs, referred to me as his favourite journalist.
I got a text message from Stuart Pearce this week, so I would imagine that makes me pretty influential. I don't know if anyone else on this conference call can say they got a text message from Stuart Pearce. Did they? No, I'm seeing blank looks all around.
He has been in my house.
Stuart Pearce has?
Yes.
Why? Was he doing some electrician work?
We were filming a thing and we needed a place to do it. And we chose my house. It seemed convenient for me.
Fair enough.
And he was deeply unimpressed with the array of terrible trophies I have in what I call the cold toilet, which is the toilet that I'm sent to first thing in the morning by Mrs. Rushton.
Fair enough.
Anyway, let's crack on. Johnny, this is the first time you've been on the pod since lockdown, or whatever we're in right now. I think you were on the final sort of normal four-person in the building pod that we did. How have you found the last month and a half or so?
Probably shouldn't say this. It's been all right. I've been quite enjoying myself. Been doing some good exercise. I've found some good HIIT classes online. I've been, you know, ordering food and drink at various points in the, you know, dealing with a baby. Occasionally doing some light work. So it's been, it's been more pleasant for me, I think, than it has for many thousands of others.
Yeah, I think I would probably echo that. It's been tougher for a lot of people, but my life hasn't changed massively. Actually, you go to a lot of football matches. If and when the Premier League comes back, are you planning to go in a work capacity?
I'd like to. I mean, I think that occasion of the first game back is going to be such a huge kind of social, cultural moment that as a journalist, I think the natural instinct is to want to be there. But I'm also conscious that I have a wife and baby at home, so there'd probably be a decision to make there. I do miss football. I miss the ritual of, you know, getting on the tube or getting on the train and going somewhere and getting lost on the way to the press room, even though I've been there a dozen times. There's like certain elements of that which I didn't realise I missed until they were sort of taken away.
Max, you returned to the Sporting Arena yesterday in the annual renewal of the Trevor Nelson Microwave Classic.
The Microwave Masters. Well, I was three down after four holes and I managed to get it back to... He went four up after nine. I got it to one up after 14 and then he stretched away with it. So for that reason, I have to retire the Microwave Anecdote for one calendar year, which I presume for listeners and certainly for you is wonderful news. It was really nice to go and do some sport. I'll say that. It felt just really pleasant to do it. I mean, what I want to do is play football and I have no concept of when I'll be able to do that again, but in its place, a round of golf was a lovely thing.
Fair enough. Nice.
Wilson, I just wondered on what Johnny said about missing the ritual and missing going to games. Have you found that? Would you want to be at the first one?
I definitely would want to be at the first one, yeah, just because I think you want to be at historic moments, and that will be a historic moment in the same way you want to be at the Champions League final, you want to be at the World Cup final, you want to be at these big moments, you want to be experiencing that firsthand so you can write about it immediately, and so you've got those memories in your locker for writing about it in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years. That will be, and this word is hugely overused, that will be an iconic day. So yeah, I would like to be at the first one. But I have to say, I've been slightly surprised by how little I've missed going to games. You know, when you think that my life for, God knows, what, 30 years has been going to a minimum of 50 football matches a year, and then suddenly having, what, this spell of, how long, I don't know, is it 2 months now we've been in lockdown? And not going. And it turns out you have loads of time, that you're not spending 3 hours on a train going to Manchester, and you're not getting to the game, you know. I mean, I get there much earlier than Johnny does, but I would try and get there 2.5 hours before kickoff because I'm paranoid and I don't like being on packed transport. And so, you know, a trip to say Old Trafford or the Etihad or Anfield, there'd be sort of 8 hours of journey time plus 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours before kickoff, plus, you know, 2 hours a game and say an hour, hour and a half afterwards. So that is 4 + 4 = 8, + 3 = 11, + another 3. That's sort of 14 hours of day. And not doing that a couple of times a week means you've got loads of time to read, to go running, to cook for yourself. I mean, there's no doubt I'm much healthier now than I normally am. But on the other hand, yeah, the adrenaline rush you get of doing a live match report, you do miss that. Just the camaraderie of being in the press room with loads of people you think you don't like, but actually turns out you do miss them when they're not there.
So the Premier League started training on Tuesday after agreeing medical protocols at a meeting on Monday. 748 players and staff were tested for COVID-19. There were 6 positive tests, Burnley coach Ian Wone among them. Adrian Mariappa and 2 of Watford's coaching staff also tested positive, causing Troy Deeney and several others to choose not to participate in group training. I think Troy Deeney had said he wasn't going to do that even before those cases. Watford, as a club, have been quite outspoken since football was postponed. Manager Nigel Pearson came out over the weekend to say he was worried about the prospect of a fatality. Simon Burnton writing in the paper, at Watford, around 7.5% of those tested were positive, enough to make Deeney's concerns look completely reasonable, perhaps even understated. Paul says, tweeted with this question, with several football players and staff testing positive, possibly causing a delay to project restart, what actual hope is there for next season? Seems ludicrous to not just finish this season when you can, because next might be a total write-off.
Yeah, I think he's right. I mean, we have mentioned before on the pod our Canadian professor friend who suggested, you know, that there's over 200 games left in all competitions this season. Why not spread them out over the next 12 months and sort of write off next season instead? And I think that's a good idea. As far as players going back and project restart, I have mixed feelings on it. If I was a player, I would go back personally, but then I'm a single man. I don't have children. I don't see much of my family. I haven't seen anyone in my family for almost half a year, I think. So it would only be me I would be putting at risk, and personally I think the risk is minimal, so I would happily go back, because just to get out of the house and to not be bored and to catch up with my mates. But I can totally understand the reservations of someone like Troy Deeney or anyone else. I think the criticism they're getting for choosing not to go back is unfair. It seems to be a case that because they're wealthy, they're obliged to dance to our tune to keep us amused. But I still don't think Project Restart will go off without a hitch. I think there'll be a second spike. I think players will test positive. It only takes one player to misbehave for it all to go wrong. And, you know, some players have misbehaved, and, you know, quite a few have been caught, and we can only imagine how many others have misbehaved and not been caught. So, and I'm not singling out footballers. It's the same in every walk of life. People have been breaking the rules.
I've sort of sensed that most people have been supportive of Troy Deeney and pretty understanding. has there been any significant criticism?
I'm only going on what I've seen on Twitter, where, and obviously it's not an accurate barometer, but it's the only one I have at the moment.
Players should just be able to choose, right?
It's interesting with Troy Deeney. Troy Deeney's at the sort of tail end of his career. He's a senior professional. He's a club captain. He's probably not that bothered about the money. If he never kicked a ball again, he presumably would be fine financially. So I think it's good that someone like him is speaking out, because younger players, say, who are on the fringes of the first team, might not have the confidence to do that, even if they felt the same as he does. So I think it's excellent that Troy Deeney's speaking out. And it's all very well saying, you know, clubs are going, well, we leave it to players to do as they wish, and the ball is in their court, it's up to them. But you can't try and tell me that there are not going to be managers out there who will make a note of, you know, who was willing to come back to training and who wasn't. And the manager has no choice but to go, well, it's his decision, it's fine, and to back him publicly. But privately, it might be a different story altogether.
I think this goes back to, you know, the new slogan that Boris Johnson unveiled like the weekend before last. I mean, I can't remember what it was, like, you know, go back to work, spend money, be a good capitalist. There seems to be an expectation that whether it's the security guard on a 0 hours contract, or whether it's the teacher or the delivery driver, that the individual's right to safeguard their own health is being subverted to the expectation that they will put themselves at risk for the good of the larger economic system. And I think the reaction that Troy Deeney has got, which is, I think is mixed, you know, to put it kindly, for putting his head over the parapet, is indicative of the way that if the default position is to keep your head down, say nothing, go out and play, and it is Troy Deeney saying, or a player like Aguero or Wayne Rooney, that has become the apostate position, speaking out and saying, well, hang on, is this safe? And I think that's the situation that we've got to, where to raise a concern, to put the merest obstacle in the path of this inexorable lust for football to happen right now, is to kind of subject yourself to a kind of ridicule, abuse, and certainly a lot of criticism.
And part of this inexorable lust is about the money, right? And about the Premier League and the broadcasters. From Jacob Steinberg's report for the paper, top flight clubs have been told they will have to give between £300 and £350 million back to TV companies, even if all the 92 games, which are outstanding, are played. For every week the season goes past the 16th of July, there will be an extra £36 million in rebates to pay. If the season instead was, say, cancelled, it would cost the Premier League clubs a combined £762 million. But my question is, does football need the broadcasters, or do broadcasters need the football? Because surely it's both, in which case they need to work out a solution to this.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I guess that depends to a large degree what the initial contract said. I mean, if you signed the contract, you signed the contract. And that, you know, although, you know, this situation, I guess, nobody envisaged, presumably protocols were put in place for what you do if the games are not completed within a certain time frame. So that's to do with the contracts they've already signed. Now, whether Sky and BT and the overseas broadcasters can sit down with the Premier League and, you know, work out some kind of compromise, I don't know. But you're right that it's a symbiotic relationship, that if the Premier League suddenly called, say, Sky's bluff and said, oh, okay, fine, but you don't ever get to bid again, or you don't get to bid for 10 years, what would happen? I guess still the value would come down, because BT or BBC or Amazon or whoever would be bidding against nobody. But I mean, that's just a situation that the market has to work out. So, you know, it's very hard to know how those discussions would go, because I guess there's a real danger that the value of football will be diminished in the future. And I think that's where you see the problem of football's economics. And it's very easy to say, oh, you know, a lot of the clubs are owned by billionaires or whatever. But if that billionaire has, say, I don't know, an ice hockey franchise and a basketball franchise and an airline and half a dozen other companies, which are also all requiring bailouts, there's no guarantee that he's got the liquidity to bail all those companies out. So yeah, the money, unfortunately, because of the way football sport has gone, you can't separate the money out from this. You can't make a purely sporting decision, because if you do make a decision purely on sporting merit, clubs are going to end up disappearing, because from the 1880s, as soon as professionalism was legalized, football and money and business have gone together.
Also, the culture secretary, Oliver Dowden, says he's hopeful of an agreement that can be reached to get some games free to air, although stressing the existing broadcast rights have to be respected. So I don't know how you do those two, but he believes the absence of a Saturday afternoon blackout, which is that enforced 2:45 to 5:15 during the regular season, would not necessarily apply to any further games this campaign, could provide what he says some flexibility, but clearly Sky and BT would need to be on board with that. Meanwhile, while we're talking about how players are feeling during this crisis, Ben Fisher in the paper saying almost a quarter of current and former professional footballers surveyed during the pandemic said they were depressed or had considered self-harm. The PFA surveyed 262 members between mid-April and mid-May to assess the impact of the crisis and found that around 14% of the 111 current players it asked felt that way. The survey also found that 24 of the whole group, equating to 9%, were experiencing difficulties with damaging addictive habits. Among current players, that figure was 2%.
There's an important point worth making that people are talking about starting up football again for the good of the footballers involved. I mean, the Premier League footballers are just a tiny portion of the professional game, and we're talking about starting up possibly the Championship and the Premier League, but that still leaves a vast corpus of professional footballers who aren't going to get to play in another game this season or pick another ball this season. And I think what it's cemented this idea that, I mean, League Two have avoided, the non-leagues have avoided, they've abandoned the season anyway, League One possibly going the same way. I think it's just kind of cemented this idea that currently football is the sort of is a game that only the very richest or those who can afford to pay are able to play, which I think is just totally antithetical to the ethos, the history of the game. It's traditionally been the sport with the fewest barriers to access, and all of a sudden it's become this incredibly sort of elite activity that you need hundreds of thousands of pounds to hold. I found that quite ironic.
A haircut news, Barry. I come to you as the most hirsute of us at the moment. Serge Aurier, Jordan and I both facing disciplinary action from their clubs after breaking lockdown rules to get a haircut. Barney Ronay writing, feels like the issue of footballers in lockdown is being interpreted mainly through Poch-era Spurs fullbacks. Danny Rose is concerned. At the other extreme, Kyle Walker is having a sex party. Serge Aurier is doing whatever he likes. What does Kieran Trippier think? It is amazing that you would break lockdown and have a haircut when you know you can't, and then Instagram having a haircut.
I mean, Serge Aurier, that's his third strike in terms of social distancing. He's never had a problem social distancing from people he's trying to mark on the football pitch, but in lockdown, he seems to have a chronic inability of staying at least 2 metres away from the nearest human being.
Moving to more serious news from Chelsea, Callum Hudson-Odoi was arrested in the early hours of Sunday morning. He was held by police on suspicion of rape after a woman was taken to hospital. He's been released on bail and has since been training with the squad at Cobham. No statement from anyone yet. We'll, of course, keep following that story. And just before we end part one, just a note to look ahead to the forgotten stories of football. Graham says, what happened to the professional who presented the last pod on fascism and football? Standards have dropped again. Graham is, of course, referring to the excellent episode that dropped into our podcast feed the other day in between normal nonsense that we give you. This week's episode is all about Manchester United's trip to Galatasaray in 1993. They wilted in the cauldron of the Ali Sami Yen Stadium, could only manage a goalless draw, went out on away goals. Welcome to hell, said the Galatasaray fans amidst a sea of red and yellow pyro, smoke, drums, flags and tifos that they'd used to intimidate visiting teams. Paolo Maldini, after Milan got dumped out of the UEFA Cup in 99, said, nobody can make me believe there are only 25,000 people in this stadium. Sir Alex Ferguson said, it was hell. I'll never go there again. It's a good story. So go and download it from wherever you get your podcast. And that'll do for part one. We'll be back in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So in Scotland, Celtic are champions of the SPFL. Neil Lennon, now the third most successful manager in the club's history. 9 in a row. They were 13 points ahead. They win with 2.67 points per game. Rangers in second had 2.31 points per game. So Lennon's men have matched the 9 in a row achievement of Jock Stein's Celtic in the 60s and 70s and Rangers run from 1989 to 1997. Probably not the way they'd have wanted it, but 9 in a row is one more on the way to the big and unprecedented 10 in a row, which is what they'll be going for next season. So I guess, Barry, however it's turned out, it's set up for next season, isn't it? Can Rangers stop Celtic?
Well, I would say the short answer to that is no, but yeah, it's not the way Celtic would have wanted to win it. And as a lot of Rangers fans have been pointing out, you know, it's a sort of a tainted victory, but I don't think there's any question that Celtic were ever going to mess it up. You know, they were clearly the best team in the league. It looked very briefly just before Christmas that we might have a title race, but after the winter break, Celtic pulled away while Rangers stumbled and clattered a few fences. And Rangers fans are entitled to say that this title will come with an asterisk, but then, you know, you could argue that Rangers Football Club comes with an asterisk, and certainly quite a few of their titles that they won in during when they were notching up 9 in a row come with asterisks because they were you know, up to all sorts of shenanigans financially. And so I don't think they have a leg to stand on in that regard. Celtic clearly were the vastly superior team in the league this season and deserved to win the title. Hearts getting relegated, they're considering legal action depending on, you know, I think they're still hopeful that the league will be restructured and they'll be allowed to stay in it. But, you know, Hearts are not getting relegated because of the lockdown. Hearts are getting relegated because they were absolutely deplorable all season. And for a team that should be, I think, fourth in the money table in Scotland, I find it very difficult to have any sympathy for them because they've been hopeless.
Barry, do you think any of these titles will come with an obelisk?
It would be entertaining, but
do you want to have another go? Just say asterisk. Can you do it?
What, am I saying it wrong?
Try it again. Say it how you say it.
Asterisk.
Okay. Now try asterisk.
Is this another of those words that I can't say? Data Neymar.
Anyway, Hearts former skipper Gary Mackay is saying Hearts have to accept the decision that's been made with more class than they've shown up to now. This is Hearts owner Anne Budge considering legal action, preparing a proposal on temporary league reconstruction after original talks broke down. Mackay continued, to continue on the back of this and to say there's maybe another opportunity to survive, it's beginning to get a bit wearing. There are so many things going on in the world just now and we're becoming a laughing stock. Somewhere along the lines, do we need to bite the bullet and say we'll be in a far stronger position in 12 months' time or however long it takes when we get back to the Premiership? They're allowed to be annoyed, even if they should accept it for, quote, the greater good. It's much easier to accept the greater good when you're not affected by the greater good.
If Hearts had shown as much fight on the pitch as they have off it, they wouldn't be in this mess in the first place. And I think it wouldn't do them any harm at all to drop a division reset because that club is a shambles.
In the EFL, League One are still discussing things. Six clubs still want to carry on. Mark Catlin, the Portsmouth chief exec, says, we think it's the right thing to do. The Premier League are currently trying to do it. The Championship are starting next week with regards to commencing training. We think we've got a moral obligation to our supporters, stakeholders, sponsors, a whole array of people. Jim Rodwell, Sunderland CEO, we believe that any league places should be determined by what happens on the pitch, not in a meeting room, most certainly not in a courtroom. As a club, we entered the league to determine the best team over 46 games, not 37. Mark Palios, Ross, the Tranmere chairman, Tranmere in the bottom three, by the way, said, if the decision is made that we will not play the season out, then I think it's quite clear the season should be voided rather than deciding on what is a mid-season change of rules and a fairly arbitrary decision as regards how we deal with promotion and relegation. Our suggested solution follows on from what League Two voted in favour of last week. And while that's not a binding vote, it's indicative of where their intentions were, and that is promotions without relegation. I'm a huge fan of promotions from all division and no relegation until every single team is in the Premier League. is the difficulty for League One, Wilson, that you probably have the widest disparity in terms of size, income, revenue, wages, etc., from the biggest to the smallest team?
Well, it is. And also League Two, just the way things have worked, their situation actually isn't that difficult in that because there are only 91 teams in the league as a Bury, they can admit Barrow, which I think most people would accept is the right thing to do. Mm. They don't have to relegate anybody. And obviously the teams who are the top of League Two want to be promoted and probably should be promoted. League One's got itself this problem because it doesn't have that flexibility. There will be one fewer team going down than normal because of the Bury situation. But yeah, you can understand why Tranmere and the other two teams at the bottom don't want this to be judged by points per game. And you can also understand why Sunderland, who are seventh, and have had a pitiful season and don't deserve to be promoted in any sense. It's been the most forgettable. It's such a forgettable season for Sunderland. It's like it's been voided in real time. It's like it's been voided match by match as it was happening. So there's absolutely no moral case for Sunderland to go up. But that Jim Rodwell quote went on, and it's an interesting point that it's a dangerous precedent to set, that you just stop a season because teams don't want to play. And it's inevitably the vested interests here. And I think this is where the what precise form of points per game you use is a really interesting argument, because once you accept that points per game, a simple points per game, may not quite be adequate, and you want to start weighting it, and you say, well, they've got six home games left and only four away, so maybe we should do it home points and away points. Why stop there? Why is that the dividing line? Why don't you move one further down the line and say, well, actually, they still have to play all of the top six, whereas this team had none of the top six left to play? And that then gets incredibly complex. And of course, you can't, at this stage, make a fair assessment of that unless you get some boffins from North Korea who've got no idea the Premier League even exists, and you lock them away in a biosecure environment, and you say to them, what's the fairest way of doing this? And they come out with the equivalent of a Duckworth Lewis charts and say, this is the way we do it. You whack it in the algorithm. But the problem is, Duckworth Lewis was invented looking at your past performance and calculating probabilities. But there wasn't a game going on at the time. So you didn't have an immediate knowledge of what the impact would be. So it's an almost impossible thing. So I think essentially you have to keep it as simple as possible. Otherwise, it becomes monstrously complex. But yes, League One also has a huge problem that you have teams like Sunderland, Ipswich, Portsmouth, who probably see themselves almost as Premier League clubs. And then you have teams like Accrington who are doing a brilliant job and getting by on a few thousand fans rather than tens of thousands of fans. And their financial situations, the way they can absorb costs, are clearly totally different.
Now, the EFL have proposed a salary cap. Third tier sides will be given 2.5 million ceiling for salaries. The sum will be 1.25 for the fourth tier. Hope to have it in place for 2021. They'd be given a vote on the introduction of a maximum 20-man squad, only 20 senior professionals at each club, containing 8 homegrown players, those produced from the club's academy system. Good idea, bad idea?
Yeah, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with it, and I accept that part of this is with a parochial hat on, that I think Sunderland should have an advantage because they get 30,000 fans a week. They're a bigger club, so I understand the logic of a salary cap if it's somehow proportional to income. I think once you make it a flat cap, I mean, how do you set a cap that's fair that can accommodate both Sunderland and Accrington, for instance? I think that's almost impossible to do. And also, there's a massive risk of reifying the gulfs between divisions, which you already see as being huge. That said, the fact that so many clubs are pushing themselves to the brink of bankruptcy to try and keep up and try and get in the Premier League is clearly unhealthy and probably unsustainable. So, yeah, I think that there is, and there has been for a long time, a reason for debate and discussion on how you can create a more viable playing field, I think a salary cap is a little bit of a blunt tool to achieve that.
If you make it a flat cap, presumably the northern sides will have a great advantage in all of this. Now, the WSL clubs assume their season is over. No decisions will be finalised until a formal consultation process concludes. Clubs are set to receive a letter from the FA seeking their views. It's understood the joint WSL and Women's Championship Board would then decide how to determine final placings. Germany's Women's League is starting on the 29th. Italy and France already cancelled their seasons. Paul Hayward wrote an interesting piece in The Telegraph saying, look, if men's football is saved while the women's game is left to its own devices, then football won't have been rescued at all. Football will have regressed. The rise of women's football and the supportive mood of the last few years will turn out to have been a mirage. Anyone who truly loves football, the game, as opposed to the tribal noise, and believes in gender equality, ought to be on their guard against the women's game being framed as dispensable, an extra expense, a nice idea that collided with the hard reality of the coronavirus and lost.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good article by Paul because it framed, I think, what is quite a complex issue that, you know, is often reduced to easy symbolism. It framed it in actually quite a nuanced way. The fact is that women's football does not and has not for a long, long time been able to sustain itself financially. And the question is, in a new landscape where very little is able to sustain itself financially, certainly in the short term, where do you kind of make those really like horrible choices? And I think there's an element to which a lot of the backing for women's football is seen as, I guess, kind of slightly soft. It's conditional. It's like a nice, you know, people like women's football as like a sort of a nice add-on to the game the main game that they follow. And I think this is a real kind of it's a real sort of fork in the road for a lot of people out there who claim to be advocates for women's football, but as we've seen over the last couple of months, there's been all the talk about restarting has been about, you know, it's been about the championship, it's been about the Premier League and the international football and the Champions League. The wave of nostalgia, footballing nostalgia that we've seen over the last couple of months, that is obviously really heavily weighted to men's football. So I think there's a real danger here that women's football has been almost treated as a bit of an afterthought. And if there is any kind of new settlement to emerge from this, then it needs to be done on a basis of equality, on a basis that you know, the men's and women's games are, you know, should be treated equally.
Obviously, the pandemic has stopped a lot of football, and it's affected a lot of players, and players who perhaps wanted to go out on a high haven't been able to. A classic example of this is Bilbao striker Aritz Aduriz, who's had to retire. He wanted to make the All Basque Copa del Rey final his final game. His body has said enough. That's what he said. He retires with immediate effect. He needs to have a hip replacement. Spain's oldest goal scorer, when he notched in 2016, aged 35 years and 275 days. So we wish him a happy retirement. A question from Joel, chaps. Like FC Seoul, has Football Weekly ever accidentally used blow-up dolls to make the audience seem fuller at a live show? This was 2016 K-League winners FC Seoul, who inadvertently used sex dolls rather than fashion mannequins to help fill empty stands last weekend.
The club... Actually, no, on a point of order, they dispute that.
Oh, do they?
They bought them from a factory to produce sex dolls, but apparently these were mannequins and not sex dolls.
Oh, okay.
I'm not 100% clear of a distinction, although I can take a guess.
Yes.
But FC Seoul have definitely... I've definitely said that.
Oh,
while
okay.
They could, from that source, have got sex dolls. They in fact, did not.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that a factory makes... I'm with you, Wilson. I'm not a massive expert on either. But it makes sense that the same factory could multitask and create the two different things.
I mean, it seems to me an issue of just popping in a different mold.
I think you're right. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three will be a roundup of your tweets and questions. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Some of your tweets and questions. Barry, a lot of feedback for your takedown of the lovely Ryan Hun on Monday. Jim, Glenn Denning Schumachering your man was the highlight for me. Dan, a lovely two-footer from the wizened Irish veteran in stoppage time. Do you have an apology for Ryan Hun, or are you sticking with your joke at the end?
No, I thought it was funny. I'm all about the giggles, and if someone has to get hurt in the process, that's too bad.
A few tweets from fans. Han says, what is your take on the recent criticism of Erling Haaland? As my father asked Jackie Oatley, don't the English have any rural men whose culture contains not using more words than you have to? I'm an urban Norwegian man. It was quite interesting that a part of Erling Braut Haaland's interview was cut, where he was very monosyllabic. He'd been less so in the earlier part of the interview. I think Lars has mentioned that, you know, he can be a bit grumpy at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think the editing is quite a key point, that if you know, he gives a couple of brief answers after longer answers where he feels he's dealt with the point, I don't really have an issue with that. You know, the idea that people from that part of Norway just don't use words, I mean, that might be true, but it does sound an awful lot like the Rio Platense Spanish excuse. You know, there must be some kind of realization there that this is an interview. He must have seen other interviews. He must understand that giving a sentence or two, no matter how banal, is actually quite useful to both parties. But fundamentally, he's a 19-year-old kid. Does it matter? If he's still doing it when he's 30, then he's a bit of an idiot. Probably somebody should take him aside and say, mate, can you just sort of, yeah, at least play the game a little bit? I think with it, you know, particularly the question about going over to the yellow wall and clapping that, I think that's actually quite an important, it's a not insignificant issue in the context of the day. And the reasons for Dortmund players doing that, I think, are genuinely quite interesting. And it's a way he could have been, he could have reached out to fans who can't make it into the stadium. So, I don't think it's a massively big deal. But at the same time, I think probably he could be a bit more accommodating.
Quite like the theatre of it. I mean, the big problem I have is, I mean, I don't have a problem with Haaland's press conferences or his interviews at all. I think the ones I have a problem with are the ones who just blather on for like 90 seconds, who just kind of fill time by saying nothing. And there are so many more footballers who do that and are trained to do that, who are trained to say absolutely nothing but fill airtime. I quite like the sort of, there's a certain rebellion to just, I'm actually not going to give this question any more time than I want to. There was a guy called, an NFL player called Marshawn Lynch, who would just, in the week before the Super Bowl, he'd just sit there and do his sort of mandated compulsory press conferences. And he would just say, like, he would answer every question with the words like, I'm just here so I won't get fined. Or he'd just say like, you know, I'm thank you for your question. And that would be it. And his press conferences, although he didn't say anything, revealed a lot more about his character and were much more entertaining viewing than any amount of, oh yeah, we played great, you know. No, but yeah, but no, we got 3 points. That's the main thing, you know. Thanks to my teammates.
Philippe writes on the subject of Stefano Aranio being the most Vic Reeves sounding player in the Premier League history. I submit Watford circa 2016 as the ultimate shooting stars team. Igalo, Gerardo, Ibarbo, Barami. It was impossible to watch Match of the Day for a few years without at least once a week shouting, Igalo indeed, Mark Lamar. Thank you, Philippe.
Well, interestingly you say that, Max, because Watford chairman or former chairman, I'm not sure what his position is now, Elton John, recently during the lockdown put on a show online in which he was singing almost in the Vic Reeves cabaret style.
Yes,
it was quite remarkable.
it was brilliant, wasn't it? Hey, now finally, Barry, something that producer Jonathan and I have been discussing for a little while, it's been mentioned by a few people on Twitter. On Saturday, you are going to be at the age at which you will be at peak unhappiness, 47.2 years old, the age that was defined by Dartmouth College economics professor David Blanchflower as the age of middle-aged misery. Thanks to Sam, who got in touch, who even set a reminder in his phone to tell us after we discussed it on a pod a few months ago. How are you feeling about this, Barry?
Slightly nervous. So, yes, Saturday is the day that I achieve peak misery in my life. I may just stay in bed for the day. I'm trying to look at the positives insofar as if I can get through Saturday, then it's rainbows and unicorns from there on in.
Well, the thing is, Barry, we thought we'd try and soften the blow for you, because obviously it must be a very difficult time as Saturday approaches. So we got a message from a friend.
Hello, Barry, the King of Baz. It's Amy here. I want to wish you a very happy and joyous day with at least as many compliments as jokes at your expense to celebrate this milestone. You are one of my favourite people at Guardian Towers. I always loved coming into the pod to be greeted by someone who looked like they skipped through a field of sunflowers without a care in the world on the way in. Effortlessly grumpy, an original thinker, and one of those people you count on to have your back if you need that. Thanks for that, Barry. Raising a glass to you, my friend. Cheers, Baz.
Oh, how lovely. It's a blast from the past, Miss Lawrence. That brought a little tear to my eye.
Do you want another message? Hey, let's have another message for Barry on this peak misery moment.
Hey, Barry, it's Melissa here, formerly of Talk Sport, where I was your assistant producer, and then Guardian Football Weekly, where I was also your colleague. Now I'm your pal. And I just wanted to say, please don't get too hung up on this most miserable milestone. You've got loads of reasons to be happy, like you've still got a really good head of hair. You know, a lot of blokes would be very jealous of that at 47. And also, I'm not sure you realise this, but when you came to my 30th birthday party last year, you were actually the only person over the age of 33 who lasted until the early hours of the morning. My friends were so impressed that at nearly 50, you managed that, even if I did have to put you in the taxi. So anyway, mate, keep your chin up.
That's true. I think it was possibly the last time I stayed up till about 3 o'clock in the morning.
This is like This Is Your Life, isn't it, Barry? do you want another one?
Oh, for God's sake.
Hello, Barry, this is Sid. I've spent the last 20 minutes trying to get Estella to bark for you. Unfortunately, she hasn't yet, so it's going to have to be just me sending you all the very best and a big hug from Spain.
Hey, Barry, Sam Dis. Can't believe we're here. The big 47.2. I know you have a reputation for being miserable all the time, but I think that's a bit unfair, really. I remember when you laughed all the way through that really traumatic England World Cup game with Colombia while me and Max just jumped around and had our head under the table and while we ate our curries and you just fucking cackled while Colombia scored. And you know what? I think in the long run, you were right to laugh. And you just sipped your beer and enjoyed the moment. I think that's the lesson here, isn't it? That laughter is a finite resource and shouldn't waste a drop. And have a good one.
Hi, Barry. I understand you might need some cheering up today, and I can't think of anything that would cheer you up more than just being reminded of the 2018 World Cup semi-finals. Watching you, watching Max, watching England lose to Croatia was definitely the happiest that I've seen you in 14 years working together. I personally have lots of happy Barry memories. Contrary to your curmudgeonly image, you're a kind and supportive colleague who I think all of us enjoy working with. My happiest Barry memories will probably always be after work drinks in the Betsy Trotswood back in the old Barringdon Road office, where Barry made me feel welcome, even at the start when I was just on work experience. So chin up, Baz. You'll be older and happier soon, and we can all get back to the pub.
Hi, Barry. It's Philippe. So you too have reached the peak of middle-aged misery. And don't believe those who say it will get better from now on, because from a peak, there's only one way to go, and that's down. Have a grand day, mon ami.
Hi, Barry. It's Lars here. I've been told that this is the day in which you will, according to some study or over, be at your most miserable. And so it's only right that we offer some kind of message of support. I honestly think people have got this all wrong, Barry. People tend to think that loners and people who are slightly downcast, that they secretly wish to be rescued, that the lonely child pottering about on the edges of the schoolyard has been forced into this isolation somehow. Now, I'm sure some sometimes that can be true, but I've gradually come to realize that you truly prefer this seemingly detached existence. I've been on a few journeys with you outside of Guardian Towers now, and I've seen how much more content you are when you're sat alone on a train, sort of far away from everyone. I've noticed your profound love of just wandering off from the rest of the group for seemingly no reason at all when we've been in some distant city or of some kind. They say there's no I in team, but there's also no team in Baz, and that's okay. The key to finding contentment in life, I truly believe, is to identify what you want as opposed to what people tell you that you should want. So I'm going to push back on this idea that you are somehow unusually miserable or downcast. I believe that you have simply attained a higher state of Baz, if you will, and on this day I believe that this should be celebrated more so than anything.
This is, it's like being at my own funeral. Yeah. Well, obviously I will be at my own funeral, but it's like being at my own funeral, but not being dead in a box. So thank you very much for organizing those inverted commas tributes.
Yeah, I think people would be more honest at your funeral. some people didn't really get the instructions and sent you birthday wishes instead.
Hello, buddy. It's Greg Bukowski here. Just want to wish you a very happy birthday. I believe it's your 47th, which some people think is a bit of a depressing birthday. Not me. I still think you have loads to look forward to. Happy birthday, Barry.
Hi, Barry. It's Solon Andy Hickman here. And I'm actually walking down Brixton High Street thinking of you. And just thinking, if I did see you, I'd probably still blank you on your birthday. No, I'm only kidding. Happy birthday. I'm sure you all absolutely hate this whole compilation of voices and the whole sentiment behind it. But nonetheless, wishing you a happy birthday as you enter a landmark year of your life in pretty mad conditions, and I hope to socially distance see you soon, probably in Brixton, probably on a very busy high road. Anyway, have a good one.
Right, couple more messages for you, Baz.
Oh, crikey.
Hi, Barry, it's Barney here. I just wanted to congratulate you on reaching your misery milestone. It's a big moment for you. But I'm confident if you keep pushing on, if you keep working at it, you can actually become more miserable. This doesn't have to be the end. And there are levels beyond this you can reach. So keep striving, and I'm backing you all the way. Congratulations.
Barry, hi, Wilson here. Hope you're bearing up on this darkest of days. I was watching a rerun recently of the Trent Bridge test from the 2013 Ashes. And it brought to mind when that game was first played. I was doing a bit of commentary at the time. And I came down on the Friday night to Brixton to meet you in your pub. Only time I've ever been there. Not going back. And we'll just have a couple of pints and go and get something to eat. That was the plan. And we did have a couple of pints. And then the next thing I remember, sitting on my bathroom floor at 5 a.m, surrounded by vomit, with a vague sense of stale tequila in my mouth. No idea how I got there, no idea what happened. Vaguely do remember a man who produced comedy. I remember a lass from South Africa and a lass from Sweden. The rest, not a thing. But I got out that day, I managed to get the tube, I got up to Warren Street where I was doing the commentary, and I was so ill in the street outside the tube station that a policewoman came up to me and asked if I wanted to go to hospital. So, keep going. Keep failing. Keep plodding on.
Two more messages for you, then you're allowed to leave, okay? First up is this one.
As a long-time listener to Guardian Football Weekly, but crucially, as an enormous fan of Barry's, meeting Barry for the first time was an awe-inspiring experience. For years, I've been captivated by the Hunter S. Thompson of the Minute by Minute, an Exocet from Birr in County Offaly, who could seemingly write missives of incendiary prose as effortlessly as most of us turn on a tap. As I nervously walked into the Guardian office in King's Cross before making my Football Weekly debut, I caught sight of him. Wearing a pair of Adidas Forest Hill trainers and a tatty jumper that just screamed, "I'm the most talented writer in this building, and I just don't give an S." He immediately offered me a coffee as I tried to gather my thoughts. "This is the guy," I kept saying to myself. "This is the guy, the writer slash broadcaster who is more able to depict the modern Irish experience than Thin Lizzy, Fontaine's DC or Daniel O'Donnell." As we took our seats in the studio, producer Jonathan asked to test our mic levels by getting us to tell him what we'd all had for breakfast, starting with Barry. I wasn't ready for what came next.
"You don't give a fuck what I had for breakfast, you shithouse cunt. You're a fucking corporate shill with his nose in a fucking trap. You make me sick, you shithouse cunt. It was nine regal if you're so fucking bothered."
Producer Jonathan said, "Thanks, Barry. What about you, Max?" To which Max replied, "Alpen."
And finally, Barry, to finish off, a special message.
"Hello, Barry. It's Jimbo. I hear you might be a bit glum, but just think, it could be worse. You could be living with me in an apartment in Vienna decorated by Boney M's stylist, which I then proceed to flood by leaving the windows open on the night the biggest storm that city's ever seen. Still can't believe we moved on after that time together in Vienna. It's like it meant nothing to us. Anyway, best wishes, chum."
Oh, Jimbo. That time in Vienna with Jimbo was very special. I'd be coming home from a night out in this Irish pub that used to stay open till about 5 a.m, and I would meet Jimbo on his way out for his morning jog. Like ships passing in the night. Thank you very much for organising. That was very kind, if not a little excruciating.
Hmm. And slightly self-indulgent, Porrick writes, "Is it time to give Barry an extended break from the pod?" So this is how I wanted to tell you that your time in the pod is over. And I hope I've replaced you with Lars on a Sunday on TalkSport because you sound pretty similar. And I hope to never see you again.
Okay.
And that'll do for today's pod. Johnny, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Wilson, thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you, Barry. Don't die on Saturday.
I will do my best not to.
Excellent news. And we will all be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.